Hello and welcome to the second podcast in this series of podcasts or series of interviews with postgraduate students in the geography department in Maynooth. Today we are with Seamus Murray, who is a postgraduate diploma student in the department, so studying geography with the hope of going on to teach post-primary. We wish him all the best. We wish he was staying to do a master's or a PhD. And Seamus's research for this class in spatial justice is on Inchicore and on the gentrification of Inchicore. But quite interestingly, or very interestingly, drawing on Rob Nixon's concept of slow violence to try to situate, I guess, more recent waves of gentrification within a much longer history of slow violence and devaluation, or what other words might you use, the kind of disrepair of Inchicore, particularly around housing.
I think I'd have used the word disinvestment mostly.
Disinvestment.
Because that covers both finance and kind of in terms of interest and support, and it kind of, in my mind, I think that phrase encapsulates quite a lot of the it's more like the disregard, it's a whole kind of taking away from any form of investment, be that time, effort, money, you know, care.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you use the words you want then. So I'll let you maybe introduce yourself a little bit more and just say how you got interested in the topic to begin with.
Yeah, so I suppose I should have jumped in with my introduction before contradicting your word choices.
No, it's fine.
My name's Seamus Murray, and like you said, I'm a postgraduate diploma student in the geography department. How I got involved in how I got interested in Inchicore was actually through one of the earlier modules in the year. Our field school module was based in Inchicore. And I suppose that kind of sparked off an interest for me. I'm also I don't live a million miles away. I live in Palmerstown, and I would regularly go climbing in Inchicore. But how I kind of got interested in the concept of gentrification and then further slow violence in Inchicore was in our field school class. One of our last classes, or one of our last field trips rather, was with John Bissett, who is a kind of a community organizer in Inchicore, and talking to him, one of the big issues at the moment is kind of the gentrification. And you can see it if you go around Inchicore, if you walk around Inchicore, kind of between when I would have first started going there to climb versus now, the kind of the type of shop and cafe and thing that's there now is you can see that it's starting to transition. There's a kind of a hipsterification of the area, very niche coffee shops and things like that, the kind of almost those stereotypical kind of ticking points of areas that are becoming kind of hipsterized and becoming gentrified, including like a pizza brewery combination. I diverged a bit there, but John Bissett's, well, what he was talking about with us at the time anyway was gentrification, and he's written a book on the gentrification of Inchicore in terms of the PPP, the public-private partnership system, and how that's kind of redeveloping areas in Dublin, and his particular area of work and where he works and organizes and is involved in the community is in the Richmond Barrack site, which was then Kyo Square, which is then most recently now St. Michael's Estate, and then, well, was St. Michael's Estate, now to several different kind of estates that they've knocked those blocks. And that got me kind of thinking about, well, gentrification in the area. And then when we were doing slow violence in the class, I kind of, maybe because it was on my mind a little bit, but I kind of saw the gentrification of Inchicore very much as being the accumulation of a series of kind of longer term issues, both around social control and also around kind of class issues in AsiaCore. And yeah, I suppose it just there is that. That's the thing about gentrification in my mind, is it's almost a subset of slum violence, in that for an area to be gentrified, it first needs to be devalued, it needs to be disinvested in. And I could see that very, very clearly happening in Inchicore. And then as a case study for slum violence, I found it quite interesting, especially in terms of using Nixon's framing of the concept.
Well, I might just get you to go back a little bit, because we've jumped straight into the these two key concepts that you use, gentrification and slow violence. And I guess, you describe something that's familiar to a lot of people, the kind of hipsterification phenomenon, coffee shops and so on. And I guess that's the kind of that's a fairly popular, superficial understanding of what gentrification is. It's the sort of thing you read a lot in the media and so on. But gentrification is a there's a lot more going on in the process of
Oh yeah, of
gentrification. And
course,
in
yeah.
terms of who, so maybe you could just explain a little bit how the concept is, how you use it, and the kind of literature that you're drawing on, and then maybe also do the same for slow violence, because I'd say that probably people, listeners, are even less familiar with the concept of slow violence.
Okay, yeah, of course. So I suppose in terms of gentrification, the main thing is it's a process basically that starts with the devaluing of an area of kind of typically it's in terms of funds and infrastructure. So, and one of those big things being housing infrastructure, but I'll move on to that in a second. So kind of an area gets disinvested from, be it by chance or by any other motivation. There can be all sorts of motivations behind it. One of the classic instances in America is kind of redlining and the financial frameworks of kind of bank loans and stuff.
That's the idea that people
It
living within certain areas can't access finance
can't access
because of
finance, exactly
race or.
that, because you are in an area that was redlined, it was deemed to be an area where you wouldn't receive return on your investment, you wouldn't
High
give out bank
risk, yeah.
loans. And that typically, when that process was brought in the States, that was not explicitly, or rather not only done as race-based, but lots of the decisions were very explicitly race-based, as in black and immigrant, but predominantly black neighborhoods were just automatically assigned a red status. On areas were given green, orange, red. Green being you will see it is a safe place to invest, you will see massive return from your investment. Those were typically upper class white neighborhoods. Orange were areas where you might see less of a return, or there was a bit of a risk, but it was still worth investing in. But obviously on, well, I say obviously, on kind of less preferential terms. And then red areas were just flat no. If you came in and you were from that area code, no, we don't give loans to you. Now, when it was put forward completely as a financial tool and a way of managing risk, kind of after recession in America. And if you take a very forgiving look at it, you can kind of understand what was trying to be done. They were trying to, recover from a recession and trying to stop banks from giving incredibly risky loans out. But when you look at the way they made those choices of where risk lies, that's where it becomes incredibly kind of insidious and a little bit, well, more than a little, very dangerous. Now, that's not actually the mechanism necessarily that happened in Shakur, but it's kind of one of the ways that areas get gentrified, in that the investment is taken away. An area then loses value or loses perceived value. And then at some point, usually a developer of some form, be it a county council or be it private individuals, kind of say, oh, there's a gap in the market there, that this place is being undervalued, and I can go in and I can invest a bit of money and I can realize that value and make profit. And like the one of the more modern versions of it is green gentrification, where people kind of revamp or redo parks and put green spaces in an area, and then all of a sudden you have people who are from a higher socioeconomic class than the people who may live in that area initially see it and made attractive to them, so they'll go in and they'll start buying houses there. And that's where kind of the core of gentrification comes in, is because you're essentially a gentrifying project is attempting to attract people of a higher socioeconomic class than the people who are currently living in that area. Those people are now attracted to it. They come in, they start to buy houses. The price to live in that area goes up. Often those areas might be areas where people are renting rather than owning, and therefore the rent goes up and it becomes a place where the initial population isn't able to afford to stay living there. And that's kind of the fundamental breakdown of gentrification, is that by an area gets disinvested from, so a certain group of people are seen as being worth living there, then when more money gets put into it, they're no longer considered worthy of that area. If you want to take a kind of a revanchist approach to it, you can kind of add those moral ideas of being worthy or not being worthy. If you want to be purely economic about it, it's a case of affordability and not affordability. But I don't think that those two things are necessarily completely distinct from each other, especially because there would be ways of revitalizing an area without gentrifying it.
Absolutely. And then how does that relate to slow violence? Maybe start again with where slow violence comes from. And I think also interesting the context in which Rob Nixon applied that concept or develops that concept, because it's quite different. They're not generally urban.
Yes, so his wouldn't have been done necessarily around urban. It would be more around. I'm not an expert on Nixon by any manner of means, in fairness, but his would have been more national issues or race issues or kind of they weren't necessarily emplaced in urban environments. They were in various different environments,
Often where there was environmental transformations.
and it kind of was developing on environmental violence. But his whole idea of slow violence was that the fallout of actions can be quite violent to a community, but over an incredibly long time period. And with environmental violence, that's a quite a particularly good approach to take to it, because things like, say, pollution and stuff, that's all the fallout to pollution and environmental change is usually cumulative. For instance, if you talk about kind of air pollution, or if you talk about water pollution, it's unlikely that the air or water that you're consuming is immediately so toxic that you're going to have an instantaneous reaction. And it may take a huge amount of time for the toxins in an area to build up to the point where they are now having negative fallout. And it'd be very difficult to link the cause and effect. And that's kind of the concept of slow violence, is that the breadth of time between cause and effect, or between cause and noticed effect rather, is so long as to occlude the actual violence happening. And violence isn't obviously this immediate kind of physical violence. It's more that concept of fallout or cost to a person or group of people. And so his idea of slow violence is that a group can suffer usually small increments of fallout over a long period of time until it builds up and accumulates into something that's quite almost or even definitely existential to that group, but that it took such a long period to happen that the awareness of that issue is kind of diluted.
Yeah, and I guess it's that. I mean, I think the problematic that he's kind of trying to get at with slow violence is that how have activists or writers, I mean, because he's coming from literature, been able to make perceptible forms of slow violence in such a way that action can be taken to arrest it or to challenge it? Because very often slow violence, because it's not perceived as violence, just it is, like you say, it's kind of it dissipates the possibility of intervention. And I think
And
one
it
thing that's
almost.
interesting about that relates to gentrification is, even going back to your point about coffee shops, people point to coffee shops because it's like one instance of something that it's much more complex and is actually bound up much more with policy rather than just like small businesses opening. You know, that's just very much the tip of the iceberg or a small part of it. But I think the gentrification also takes place over a long time. Like you started this interview by saying you used to go climbing there and you can notice changes, but it's over a long period of time. And even
And
though
even
people
then,
ex
that period of time is actually like the period of time of my interaction with Inchicore is nowhere near the actual period of time that I would consider if you're talking about the gentrification or the slow violence of gentrification in Inchicore.
Yeah,
Like
exactly,
the
which we'll go
timeframe
into in
I'm
a
looking
bit.
at.
Because
Yeah.
I think that sometimes you do have projects, like I think about the Olympics in London. You do have these large urban development projects which are about completely, remaking, a whole area in the interests of a particular project, and that's about displacing people. It's about like in a short period of time, and that
Yeah.
does get like you can see does get often more. More opposition, more resistance. But this type of gentrification, I think that you're talking about in Inchicore, and that others obviously are writing about. I think where it links up well with slow violence is that idea of things being, incremental and gradual and extended over long periods of time, and why
Yeah,
it's so important
absolutely.
to bring attention to it.
But I think now I don't know enough about the issue of the Olympics in London. I don't actually know the history of the sites that the buildings are built in, but I would imagine if you were to go and look at it, that that is not happening in, the people they displaced weren't millionaires. They weren't knocking down, they were
No.
knocking down flats, not millionaires' homes. And
Yeah.
so the thing with slow violence is that it can, I think, accumulate in quite rapid things towards the end. Quite immediately apparent things towards the end. And I think that that's not necessarily a gap or an oversight in Nixon's framework of it, but that he, I suppose maybe he looks at slow violence as something that's always going to be slow, and that it can be a slow build up to something that can then eventually escalate into something that's very, very immediately obvious. But at that point, it's often or usually too late or very difficult to challenge it.
Yeah, and I think one of the examples he does touch on is climate change. And I think, you look at what's happening in India, Pakistan, that part of, even as we're talking with the high temperatures, which is a very, dramatic,
Accumulation of a very slow process.
of
Yes,
emissions that
absolutely.
have been made, yeah, for,
Yeah.
decades, if not centuries,
And
yeah.
also to give Nixon his due, he wrote the initial piece in 2013, 2015, I can't remember which. Like long enough back that anything that I any criticism I give on it, I have the benefit of hindsight sometimes on some of that. But I do think that the London case, for instance, is still very much a slow violence in that if you were to look at where those sites were, where
Yes.
construction is sited, it's done in areas that are essentially cheap to build in.
Yeah, so it's already been
And
happening.
it's already been happening, and you have to look at why they're cheap to build in. Like, was it cheap to build in because no one ever had any use for it? That's unlikely. It's more likely to be cheap to build in because it was the site of high density, cheaply built housing, where they wanted workers in near London to be doing sort of industrial work and things like that. And now it's seen as a site where, oh, it's, these are low quality houses. These are, and some of these things are not objectively untrue. Like, for instance, the flats that were knocked down in Inchicore, the St. Michael's. I'm going to move away from London simply because it's not my expertise and I could end up saying something completely wrong. But St. Michael's buildings, like they weren't well designed. They were quite cheaply done. They were run out with damp. There were huge design issues in it. They weren't particularly safe. Talking to John Bissett, he said a lot of residents didn't feel safe because they had no way of actually limiting access to the building to anybody. And I can't remember the dates or timelines he gave me, but he said that at some point in kind of 19, I'd say 60s, 70s, 80s, like I know that's a big time frame, but there was a move to push kind of unwanted itinerant population out of Dublin city centre. So you're talking about homeless people and people on drugs, and that became more heavily policed in the city centre. But as you got progressively further out of the city centre, it got less and less heavily policed. So eventually you had drug addicts and alcoholics and people who are sleeping rough being moved out of the city centre until they reached the point where they were no longer being moved along, and that happened to be in Shkor, and so people in the flats didn't have any ability to restrict access for people who are on drugs to getting into the flats and sleeping on their in their hallways, in their stairwells and stuff like that. And that's part of the whole process of, if you have a policy that says we don't want X group of people in this location, in this instance, drug users in the city center, we're going to just move them along. It's downstreaming the issue. And it wasn't so much one of the things I talked about in my piece, but it's essentially saying we can downstream until it reaches an area that we deem to be a wasteland. And in this case, it ended up being kind of St. Michael's Estate in Inchicore.
It's interesting you use the term wasteland there, because I was going to say it that in the podcast previous one with Caitlin, talking about bog landscapes, and particularly up in the northwest where you went on the field trip in Leitrim. And talking about this idea that these landscapes are seen as good for nothing but wind farms and Sitka spruce plantations, and it's the similar idea that these spaces are not just naturally, poor. I mean, there are, environmental geological properties of these places, in terms of the land, but the idea that they're good for nothing but those types of, large scale projects is a product of historical, policies. Disinvestment, non-investment, things like that, and there's a
Absolutely.
clear
And
parallels.
the working class history of Inchicore is actually, you can very much pin it down to an instance, which is when the railway works set up in the late 1800s. I can't remember the exact year, but when they set up the railway works factory and then the train lines, they also built corporation housing for the staff, for the workforce. And now those would have been well-respected working class jobs at the time. Like, they were typically quite good ones, and also actually at the time viewed as being significantly better in terms of housing than, say, living in the tenements. But the Inchicore before that was predominantly rural suburban. There was a few things. There was the barracks, there was Camanum Jail, there was a couple of schools and kind of buildings like that. But by and large, it wasn't a dense population area. And then they built high density housing for workers in Inchicore, and pretty much since that moment has been a working class area. And then just over time, I suppose there was kind of the, well, there was part of it is probably to do with an economic shift between working class and like kind of the creation of a middle class. And that led to like essentially value choices being made subconsciously, even about where, the value of a working class person, in that if it was essentially kind of working class and then kind of a bourgeois class, if you're going to go to quite a Marxist look at it, adding in the middle class now makes the working class kind of bottom of three instead of bottom of two, or even, you would have had maybe a serf class, working class, and then above. I think it's kind of an interesting thing that you can see that Inchicore was always built as a working class area and always has been a working class area, and then as social perceptions of the value of the working class changes, you can see a quite a large level of disinvestment of interest from the area.
Yeah, and I guess it's not just social perceptions of working class, it's that the, the organization of the economy is no longer around a working class. It's not an industrial economy, and you
Yeah,
see
it
this
becomes a
more
service
so in
sector.
other countries where there's been, a much bigger industrial sector, but more and more those jobs don't exist. And
Yeah,
so
exactly.
those areas that had relied on pretty well-paid, secure, wage jobs, that's not really the kind of employment anymore. And
Yeah, and then once And the interesting thing is that kind of once that level of employment lost its level of importance, you can kind of see policy that then said, well, that group of people have lost their importance as well. And the more economics focused your governance becomes, the more your like an individual's economic output becomes important. And then you can kind of slowly see that becoming a cycle of disinvestment and wastelanding, like turning an area into a wasteland.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see it even more starkly with the, inner city Dublin, around the ports, where there would have been a lot of employment in the ports, and that's prime real estate. And, since the
Absolutely.
70s with the ports, with containerization and so on, I mean, there's been very clear, I'd say more, maybe more clear. I mean, that's where there's a lot of this work is focused by geographers, is on how those communities have been, forced out, but more kind of amazingly is how those communities have resisted that and continue to live there
Yeah,
despite.
and probably more importantly as well, I think there should be, I know I'm definitely guilty of it in that I haven't maybe put as much focus on the resistance as I have the oppression. And it can be quite an important, like it's a very important story to tell, is the story of the resistance against things. And without telling that, you lose sight of the story that's being overwritten by either slow violence or by gentrification or by whatever issue is your particular interest. If you focus purely on the oppressive nature of the story, you are now preferencing one person's story over another. And
That's
even if it's in a negative slant, you're still only telling the one story, I suppose.
yeah, and it's not always just in one direction, is it?
No.
Well, I wonder if you could just, because I know you've touched on different elements of it, but just even for my own understanding is, with the Inchicore, the railway works, end of the 1800s, the building of this housing, is that by the corporation or is that by the railway company,
It's by the railway company.
which
Sorry,
is a
when I
private.
said public, yeah, private owned, like
It's like Guinness or something.
like Guinness had built it, exactly.
Yeah, so it's
It
a kind
was
of a
all owned.
paternalistic type thing. It wasn't state or public housing, it was a company housing.
It was company housing. Company town, yeah, rather than corporation town, I should have said a company town.
And then that sort of lasts until, I mean, through the independence into the 20s. Yeah,
And beyond a
and
bit.
that's the kind of, and then into the, I guess in the 30s is when there's big housing. More housing schemes. I don't know if that's the case in Inchicore, but maybe if you could take us from, say, the 30s up until, I guess present in terms of the key, I don't know, the key phases of development or shifts in Inchicore.
Okay, well actually I'm gonna be sl it is actually around about the 30s. It's just before the 30s. It's in 1925, the Richmond Barracks, which is the site now of the kind of the buildings that I was talking about in the essay. So the Richmond Barracks had been obviously ceded to the Irish Army. Then the Irish Army essentially gave it over to the state to use as emergency housing because of how bad the housing situation in Dublin had gotten. So it was essentially converted and into a kind of essentially kind of flats, but they didn't change anything about the building. It was just very much what used to be barracks rooms were then converted into housing. And it pretty much stayed in that state for quite a long time. And it's important to note that it would have been seen as quite a good move at the time, and that it was a step up from tenement housing. I think the space, there would have been slightly more space. And that existed up until the 1960s, the late 1960s. It was only in 1969 that the majority of the barracks was actually torn down to make way for the building of new public housing. And that was then St. Michael's Estate, which was kind of a series of flats built there. Again, initially viewed probably as quite a good, when I say initially viewed as, I am drawing very much on conversations with John Bissett. But it would have been seen as quite a good thing. And the barracks would have been seen as quite a good thing. Like the people who lived there self-identified as the barrackers. There was a huge sense of community. There's a film by a an Irish filmmaker called Joe Lee, Whatever Happened to St. Michael's Estate. And he kind of talks to a lot of people who would have lived in the area when they were quite young or when it became St. Michael's Estate. But he said that there was, the constant refrain in that film and in talking to anybody who worked in the area at the time of the barracks was that there was a huge sense of community. It was a very, the infrastructure had fallen apart, but the community hadn't. And when they built St. Michael's Estate, it was seen to kind of keep that sense of community. It broke it up slightly in that it took time to move from the barracks to the estate, but there wasn't quite as much of a case of dispersal, I suppose. People weren't moved along quite as much. But it didn't take a huge amount of time. Like the time between St. Michael's Estate, the flats being built, like the first one would have been opened in 1970, and the last one was demolished in 2013. So it only took kind of 43 years for a project that was quite a large scale social housing project, which was supposed to replace what had been, a kind of an emergency move that then lasted for well, a similar 40 odd years. And then inside the space of another 40 something years with purpose-built accommodation, it had reached the point where it was voted to demolish them rather than try and refurbish them because they had been cheaply made, bad planning practices. At the time of that boom of social housing in Dublin. And it's around about then in 2013 that that's when you saw or when you see the what I suppose I would call the move from I suppose booms of investment and disinvestment in that you kind of you had the barracks people had there was an issue with housing in Dublin, so they used the barracks as social housing. And then they were happy to leave it be like that and to let it really, really kind of fall into dereliction for 40 something years. Then they knocked it and built the estate. And again, kind of it peaks up a bit. And then it was happily just left to again fall into disrepair and have drug issues be kind of a lot of people who lived there in the early days would say moved into the area. That the kind of the drug issue didn't originate in St. Michael's Estate. It was moved in and then it stayed. And so you see these kind of two boom bust cycles of a brief amount of care and investment and then just let it go. And then that happened again. And then in 2013 they knocked those flats, they moved people away, and the it is important to note that the community actually decided to knock the flats. Like they were part of that decision. But very quickly after that, the move away from, I suppose, a more traditional public housing model to the PPP model happened, and that's when people in the estates kind of started to see their interests not being championed anymore, that weren't being paid attention to anymore, and that was the start of gentrification in the area. So previous to then, all of the kind of refurbishment work in the area or the rehabilitation work in the area, when they moved the barracks to social housing and then when they knocked those buildings to build purpose-built social housing, it was always done with the intent of it being social housing and it being, not for profit. It was done by and funded by the state. It was very much inside that social model of social housing. The gentrification started to happen now once they knocked those blocks. The council started to very quickly, or the Dublin Corporation started to very quickly renege on agreed upon strategies of refurbishing. And when they moved to the PPP model, that stops being strictly social housing because you've moved private money and private interests in, and in the economic model that currently exists, they are going to be building housing for profit. And that's the entire goal of the capitalist economy is to build for profit, or to make for profit, or do whatever you're going to do for profit. And so you fast forward that to now, and you see the plans that are being built in the area, and it's no longer entirely for social housing. It's now a mixed tenure project. You have certain percentage for social housing, certain percentage for affordable housing, certain percentage for, you know, for sale for profit housing. And when you look at the affordable housing model that they're going for as well, it's a different model to what used to exist in Dublin, in that it is, it's based off of the cost of building the units, as opposed to off of the income of the family that live in the unit. And the important difference there being that it adds a minimum price point. Whereas previous to that, if you only made €500 a month, now these are completely abstract figures, but if you're only making €500 a month and you were being told your rent was 10% of your monthly salary, it was €50. If you then made 560, it became €56. And then if you went down to 480 euro, it was now 48 euros. It was your rent hinged on what you made. The model that is now being adopted is that the rent is based off of how much it costs to build the unit, which means that you may be struggling for housing, but if you built these units at whatever cost, you may be struggling for housing, but you still won't reach that minimum cost to be able to pay off the housing. And that's there because the public-private partnership requires that they don't build any of these units at a cost themselves.
I mean it's a, thanks for it. That was a long bit of talking you did there, and it was a really a kind of good account of that history since the 1930s, and particularly the very sad more recent history with the shift towards public-private partnerships. And obviously Michael's estate wasn't the only estate that went through that, or is going through that that process. And I wonder, because we're reaching the end of, and there's lots of things I'd like to ask you about, but just to go back to your point about resistance, and I guess, one aspect of resistance is remembering these histories, and even just being able to point out that the current situation is not just accidental or is not just natural, but has been the result of specific policies, which are reflection of specific ideologies, specific interests, and have had all sorts of very material negative adverse effects, violence on people, on communities. And so telling those stories is really important, and John Bissett has been, really important figure in doing that for, 20, 30 years, I'd say. And Joe Lee, you mentioned with the filmmaking. And I know that you had done this blog post based on your work in the field, the field school class, and that involved some visualizations of some work you did on the census from 1913. Yeah. I wonder if you could just maybe you could touch on that, and maybe just talk a little bit about what you consider to be the importance of particularly visual or artistic or creative interventions that can, I guess, not just tell these histories, but circulate them beyond just those communities that have been affected, because a lot of people don't know about this stuff.
I suppose in terms of the importance of kind of artistic and visual visual interpretations or tellings of the stories, I think at least for me, and this is definitely, I think the importance of artistic storytelling is massively personal, as much in terms of what type of art speaks to you versus what type of art doesn't. But I think if you can make information visual, it's much more easy to engage with it. Mapping the patterns of disinvestment over a period of time you could very quickly kind of, I could see how you could make very interesting visual representations where someone could look at it and immediately know that something bad is happening.
One, maybe just to go back to Michael's estate, because it's so, important and such a central part of your story, and just your visit with John Bissett, and maybe you could just say something. I don't know what is the current situation there with residents, with the development, that you had heard about from him.
I'm loath to try and put words in anyone else's mouth, so I can only relate what John said to me. We didn't have a huge amount of time to interact with residents themselves. But he kind of framed it in very colonial terms. There's essentially one green or brown field site, depending on how you want to refer to it. There's a large green field in that's not been developed on much in the middle of what used to be St. Michael's Estate. And several areas that have like several areas where there were flats have where the flats were knocked down have been rebuilt as new flats or new types of accommodation. And this large green field in the middle is now the kind of the last site that's being contested. And John said it as he looked at it in the same way that the kind of the land grab treaties in America with Native Americans, that if they sign away this last piece of land, like that's the last nail in the coffin. That's the he kind of looks at it as Inchicore being colonized by private interests, and that I suppose there's that sense of they really, really need to fight to have their representation in the decisions for the building in that site, because after that, that's it. That's the end of the project. So this is, I suppose, the feeling I got from John at least was that this is their last chance to make a very material difference, like in terms of built infrastructure in the area. Because once this is built, it's not going to be unbuilt, or at least not for 40 odd years if you look at the kind of the history of the area. So this is not the last standing, that obviously the community in the area will still exist and will still be able to resist and will still be able to fight to live in an area that will get progressively more expensive. But this is their last opportunity to really make their mark in terms of what facilities they want, how the building should be built to reflect the history of Inchicore and to reflect the needs and desires of the people who live there now, as opposed to the needs and desires of the people who are being attracted into the area.
That's a good way of putting it. And I guess, thinking about that as the last stand makes me think of, and also knowing a bit about John Bissett and his work is just how astonishing it is that they have been resisting and been, fighting for their inclusion and their needs and their desires, for such a long time. And I guess that's the flip side of the slow violence, is this sort of slow resistance,
Absolutely.
and the endurance that these communities and activists, organizers go through. I mean, such a long, long, long time that they're
Yeah,
doing this work, and how
the
exhausting it
incredible
is.
resilience of it is impressive. Like I'd be worried if John was to listen to this and him think I was saying that if this doesn't go his way, that that's the end of it. And I can't imagine him dropping it. And even if it is to go his way, I can't imagine that's the end of things for him anyway. But I think from talking to him, it seemed to be very much that this is the last chance to get it in the built infrastructure. And built infrastructure is important because that's the medium through which people are going to live in that area.
Okay, well, I think that's a good point to end it on. And thanks so much for it was, really detailed and interesting. And I think, bringing together these ideas of gentrification and slow violence is a really useful one, and putting it into this much longer historical context. So
Yeah,
hopefully.
I hope it wasn't too shallow and kind of washy.
Well, I
Yeah.
mean, I think that the listeners, people who are listening, will know. I mean, this is it's a postgraduate class in spatial justice. It's a relatively short amount of time you get to research these things, and there's
Yeah.
no expectations or claims to being a thorough expert on these things, but it's enough, I think, for people who don't know much about the concepts, you know, much about Inchicore, the history. I think definitely, you know, people would have learned a lot. I certainly did, so
All right,
thanks.
well, thanks very much, and
Thanks.
enjoy the rest of the podcasting.